Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now in depth on what happens next with the U.S. Supreme Court.
We need a Supreme Court that, in my opinion, is going to uphold the Second Amendment and all amendments, but the Second Amendment, which is under absolute siege. I feel that the justices that I am going to appoint, and I've named 20 of them, will be pro-life. They will have a conservative bent. They will be protecting the Second Amendment.
That is President-elect Donald Trump during the campaign, and his potential justices may have made the lists of many Republican presidents. But if he gets to appoint more than one justice to the U.S. Supreme Court, he has the opportunity to shape the direction of the court for years to come. Today, a discussion with two guests about how the makeup and the chemistry of the court are likely to change and what that means for some of the big issues headed the court's way. As our guests join us this morning, I'm interested in how important the Supreme Court was in your vote for president. And which court issues are you most concerned about? So if you're one of those Supreme Court voters, and we're going to talk about that this morning, I want to know how that figured into your decision around who to vote for president for and which court issues are you most concerned about. Here's the phone number, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, StephCurtis@NPRNews.org/live. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Kimberly Atkins is with us. She's a columnist with the Boston Herald, and she's with us from Washington, D.C. And Kimberly, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Jawando is with us. She's vice president for legal progress at the Center for American Progress, and she's also with us from D.C. Michelle, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, Michelle, in September, you wrote this piece in which you said, quote, being a Supreme Court voter is different than being a single issue voter. So talk to me about that. Why?
Yeah. So, you know, as we get we're on our way to one of the most consequential elections in American history, I thought it was important to kind of put into context for voters and to think about the weight of the Supreme Court in our lives. You know, we often talk, particularly in D.C., about the legislative branch and what's happening in Congress, and we talk sometimes ad nauseum about what the president is doing, but less around the third branch of government. And if you pay attention to what's happened before the court over the last 30 years, in many ways, we've seen a restrained court that has tended to have more of a pro-corporate kind of strain if you look at many of the cases. And I think it was important for progressives and the American people writ large to really understand the weight of the power of the Supreme Court and recognizing that the effect on issues, whether you're talking about a constitutional right to individual liberty, i.e. in Roe v. Wade and making autonomous choices with your body, or whether you're talking about issues around access to higher education and the continued use of recognizing race as you consider as a factor in higher education. These are all issues that continually come before the court. And I thought it was important to kind of put that in context around the election.
Kimberly, I'm interested in whether you think the future of the court ended up turning more voters than we expected into Supreme Court voters with all of the dimension that Michelle just described.
Yes, I think it's interesting. During the course of the election, I really expected the Supreme Court to be a huge issue in this election, even before the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia, and certainly afterwards when we saw how almost immediate the effect of having a vacancy on the court was with 4-4 splits, the court more reluctant to take on cases that could be controversial. And a lot of these issues are really important issues to voters, as you were discussing. But it seemed, at least among the folks that I talked to, that it didn't resonate on the campaign trail the same way as a lot of the issues that the candidates talked about, such as immigration and economics. It just doesn't translate to a good talking point on the campaign trail, despite the fact that it is so hugely important now and more than in recent history. The court has been so important in the election than it's ever been.
Call here from Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe. Sounds like you have a legal and professional and personal interest in this. Is that right?
Yes. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I voted for Hillary, and one of the number one reasons was because of the Supreme Court. I mean, Mr. Trump's going to be able now to fill in Justice Scalia's seat since he died. And then most likely what could happen is Ginsburg, Kennedy, and Breyer could be up. I mean, Justice Ginsburg is 83. Personally, she should have retired at least 2 years ago and had Obama pick a successor.
Uh-huh.
Kennedy is 80 and Breyer is 78. And so he could get anywhere from 2 to 4 appointments. That's immense. You could change everything. You can change reproductive rights, campaign finance, First Amendment. You can change so many things. The power that Mr. Trump's going to have over this court is something that I don't like, and I don't think most in the legal community likes. And again, I think Justice Breyer should have retired at least 2 years ago.
Kimberly, do a lot of Democrats and other court watchers that you talk to for your stories agree with where Joe is, this scenario that he's spun out?
Oh, certainly. And you know, folks like me have been writing about this for a long time, where you do have this sort of dichotomy of the court. You have several fairly young justices and several fairly older justices on the court. So the idea that the next president, whomever won, would be able to appoint up to 4 justices was very real. And given that, I mean, the first appointment, of course, will be replacing Justice Scalia. In that sense, it won't change the court much. It'll be a conservative replaced with a conservative. But beyond that, you're absolutely right. It will be immense changes to the court. And when you think about how many times in recent years the court has come to a 5-4 decision on some of these big issues, whether it's same-sex marriage and gun control, that next appointment after the one to replace Justice Scalia will be a massive one.
Michelle, I just want to focus on Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg for a second, because Donald Trump actually talked about her during the campaign in some pretty rude and dismissive ways. At one point, he said she was a disgrace. He said that her mind was shot. I wonder if that is incentive within, you know, whatever control Justice Ginsburg would have on this, for her to try to decide to stay and deny him the chance to name her replacement.
You know, I think there is a reason she is called the notorious RBG. And I think it speaks to this issue. You know, Justice Ginsburg, she later apologized for many of these comments, but throughout the course of the campaign really noted the difficulty of imagining a President Trump and what that could mean for the court. I think it is really important to kind of preface this conversation with remembering that Senate Republicans, for the past year, Justice Scalia passed, had an untimely passing in February of 2016. And so for the past year, Senate Republicans have refused to move forward on President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, Chief Judge Merrick Garland of the D.C. Circuit, and who has long been considered one of the most qualified and centrist nominees ever to the Supreme Court. So the backdrop of this entire conversation is the fact that we have seen an unprecedented level of obstruction, not based on qualifications. This wasn't a Bork kind of obstruction. This wasn't a conversation about qualifications. This was simply about kind of partisan control of the Supreme Court. And that is dangerous, just as we continue to think about integrity and independence with our various functions of government. I mean, you have the possibility potentially to have a president-elect who many people know has issues around temperament and character, who has the ability to control dynamics in 3 branches of government. And for those who care about our institution and writ large, our ideas about democracy and independence, that should be an area of concern for us all.
You know, Kimberly, it was funny because what Michelle is saying about the Merrick Garland situation. I heard an interview this morning that David Greene was doing with a member of Congress, and they were talking about confirmation of some of Donald Trump's appointees. And he asked, do you think the Democrats in Congress will give his appointees some of the, or he's not, these nominees, the Merrick Garland treatment, where they basically slow walk, you know, or maybe this was Rachel, Rachel Martin, I think, was asking about this. Well, basically, they slow walk the confirmation process. So it sounds like there is still some residual anger over the way Merrick Garland was treated. What do you think the effect of that is? How does it ripple through the Trump administration?
Well, I think that there are some Democrats who would be happy to reciprocate the treatment that Judge Garland got. But I think the more pragmatic members of the Senate, the Democrats on the Senate, probably would not want to do that. First of all, it's tougher to do now because Republicans are still in control of the Senate.
Right.
So it would be a lot more difficult to stall in the way that we saw the GOP leadership do with Judge Garland's nomination. But there are people people who are slightly more pragmatic. I talked to Cory Booker about this, and he says that's not really what he's there to do, and that's not in the interest of government to try to take a bad example and go by it. So I think in this case, you're going to look, we would expect conservative nominees under a Republican president, and that's something that we'll see. I think the battles over confirmation, frankly, are going to be much more focused on the cabinet positions as President-elect Trump puts his team together, at least for this first nomination, than it will be on the Supreme Court pick.
This is a conversation as we consider the future of the U.S. Supreme Court. President-elect Donald Trump will be able to make a nomination early in his term, and because of the late Justice Antonin Scalia's passing. But we're also looking at how, if some of the other justices decide to retire, how Donald Trump could have a big impact on shaping the future of the court, the implications of that, what it means for some of the issues that are headed toward the court. I'm going to talk to our guests about that. And I think about the chemistry of the court, too. So I'm interested in how important the U.S. Supreme Court was in your vote for president. Was it something that you were thinking about? Are there particular issues that you're most concerned about? Or as a Donald Trump supporter, this was something that was front and center for you as you voted in November, and now you're looking ahead to seeing the court consider a particular issue that you're interested in. 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Lynn says husband's family member voted Trump solely to flip the Supreme Court to abolish Roe v. Wade. We haven't spoken since the election. To the phones to Nick in River Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Nick. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking about this?
So the biggest issue that I saw in this election was the issue of Citizens United and campaign finance reform, and I view this as the biggest issue. It's part of the biggest reason why I supported Bernie Sanders in the primary, and it was also noticeably absent in both Hillary Clinton's campaign talks along with Donald Trump. So it's the reason that I actually ended up casting a vote for Jill Stein. And I view this as really the pillar of democracy, and not being able to for corporations to be able to donate essentially unlimited sums of money for political candidates.
So you're worried now about the fact that Citizens United looks like it will be the law of the land for some time to come.
Yeah, I think it's going to become the precedent, and it's going to become just the new normal. If you remember, you know, not so long ago, there were campaign donation limits, and I believe that is healthy for a democracy, that wealthy individuals and corporations should not be able to, you know, as Bernie Sanders would say, buy the election. I think that's number one issue that really isn't being talked about.
Kimberly, tell me if this is right. I thought that Congress, there had been some discussion about Congress repealing Citizens United, but nothing ever came of that. Is that true?
Well, because it was a constitutional ruling by the Supreme Court, Congress cannot repeal Citizens United. It would either take a reversal by the U.S. Supreme Court or a constitutional amendment that could either be started by Congress or started by the states, but a hugely complicated and difficult process to do. So in that case, your caller's right. The Supreme Court was a major issue because that really would be the only avenue, the only feasible avenue for changing that law.
Let me ask you this, since we had a tweet about Roe v. Wade. Put overturning Roe v. Wade aside for a minute. What else could a new conservative-leaning court do to restrict access to abortion? And I'm asking this with awareness that, you know, some of the federal courts now have weighed in on some of the laws in Texas and other restrictive access issues in other states. So what could the court do if we take overturning Roe v. Wade off?
Yeah, I think before you get to the point where Roe v. Wade would be revisited, you'd see action on a lot of these rules that apply restrictions. Restrictions on access to abortion services, laws that require, for example, that any facility where abortions are performed have to have, require them to have hospital-style facilities, you know, elevators that are able to hold gurneys and things like that, which most clinics where this thing, where abortion services take place, don't have. And that has a tendency to shut down a lot of these facilities. It would also require people who perform abortions to have an affiliation with a local hospital. A lot of these doctors do not. Things like that, that just really dramatically limit the number of clinics where abortions are performed. We're going to see a lot of challenges to those laws come up before I think the court will try to, you know, go against stare decisis and reconsider Roe v. Wade altogether.
And Michelle, Mark in Burnsville here says Trump said the Supreme Court wouldn't end abortions, but would put the issue back to the states where it would still be legal in blue states. I mean, there is evidence that Donald Trump supported the legal right to an abortion earlier before he decided to run for president. Do you have a clear idea of where he stands on something like Mark is raising here?
Well, you know, I think it's important to look at who Donald Trump has released as kind of the names of 21 potential nominees. And I often, and you hear this quite often, that people are policy. And so when you think about kind of the list of some of the candidates, many on his list have very radical ideological views and would likely kind of roll back decades of established constitutional principles in many areas, particularly in the space around choice. So, for instance, Judge Neil Gersh, who serves on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, joined an opinion that essentially allowed corporations to assert religious objections to laws that protected their employees' legal rights.
Right.
If you kind of extend what that could mean also in a context of a Supreme Court that passed a supported Hobby Lobby, a decision that treated corporations like citizens with rights in that case, you can imagine how arguments around religious freedom and in context with issues around choice could play themselves out with impact litigation during a Trump kind of court. I think the other area that we will continue to see change, and not in the direction that I think most Americans will look at, is that this court has definitely made it easier for companies to discriminate against women and the elderly. And I have no reason to think that that would change. So in 2007, Ledbetter versus Goodyear, that was another 5-4 decision, and the court essentially ruled that a woman who had been paid less than her male peers for 20 years had no right to bring a lawsuit for equal pay because of a timing point, because she failed to bring suit within 180 days, even though she had no way of knowing about the discrimination. Those decisions and others like that are decisions that I think kind of with the number, with the names that you hear about the Trump nominees, are decisions that will continue to stand. And I think that that should be an area of concern as we consider who this court will side with on many of these issues around individual rights and liberties.
John in Roseville people called to say, I voted for Trump completely because of the Supreme Court issue. I didn't want Hillary to destroy the Supreme Court. I'm in favor of Citizens United. I'm also against abortion. I'd like to hear from more of you. If you supported Donald Trump and you've been thinking about the U.S. Supreme Court, which are the issues, perhaps, that motivated your interest in his nominations to the court and your interest in supporting Donald Trump? So if you're a Trump voter, talk to me about where the U.S. Supreme Court issue figures into your support for the president-elect. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828, NPRnews.org/live, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Not Joshing here says, if the president-elect wants to take steps to heal the nation, it would do a lot to insist on Judge Garland getting a hearing and a vote. Kimberly, I assume that isn't going to happen. Are there some people on the list that Donald Trump put out during the campaign that you think might rise to the top?
Yes, I think it is safe to say that Judge Garland, who has already resumed his duties back on the D.C. Circuit, that ship has sailed. Donald Trump's list of 21 people who he put together with the help of the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society's conservative legal organizations is different than we've seen in a lot of ways. There are far more people from state courts than circuit courts. Usually the last several Supreme Court appointments have been from the federal courts. It's sort of seen as the pipeline to the Supreme Court, particularly the D.C. Circuit. You don't see a lot of that here. Also, the court right now is really bicoastal. You have a lot of people from the East Coast and the West Coast and not a lot of people from the middle of the country. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's list has a lot of people from Texas, from Michigan, from Utah, a lot of places that we have not seen a justice from for a long time. So, I mean, it includes some people who have been on the GOP radar for a while, like Diane Sykes of the Seventh Circuit. But it also includes different and unusual people like Judge Don Willett, who is on the Texas Supreme Court, who is also an avid tweeter. So that might be someone that Donald Trump takes an interest in.
Kimberly, Donald Trump made a lot of statements during the campaign that seemed to indicate that he was questioning the current limits on presidential authority. And I'm thinking of some of the things he said, perhaps around the religious test for immigration and some of the other issues. Now, I wonder if he runs the risk of nominating someone who might disagree with him on those authority questions and whether he can suss that out as he does some of these, has some of these conversations with potential nominees.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the most interesting issues that we will see play out in the Trump administration. If you recall, Republicans in Congress challenged President Obama repeatedly over the limits of presidential authority on issues like his immigration order, on environmental orders. And by and large, they were successful in those and some other areas. The courts did rule that the president had exceeded his authority to do that. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has promised to use executive authority with just as much gusto, if not more, than President Obama did. So he may face a Supreme Court that does sort of rein in that ability if challenges are brought by Democrats in Congress, which I think we can almost guarantee those challenges will be brought.
If you just joined the conversation, you're hearing from Kimberly Atkins. She's a columnist and the chief Washington reporter for the Boston Herald. And Michelle Jawando is with us. She's a Supreme Court expert at the Center for American Progress. Steph, off the page.
Alicia says, my decision to vote for Trump was heavily influenced by his choice and potential choices for the Supreme Court. The Second Amendment and its support is something that is very important to me. Hillary was for gun control, and I couldn't support that.
Call here from Tim in Eden Prairie. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, tell me how you're thinking about the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, you know, I was a reluctant Trump voter, like many out there, who didn't really think too highly of either candidates.
Okay.
But the Supreme Court weighed heavily for me. I just didn't want to see the balance of the court really shift to either side. I think it's pretty valuable that we have an equal amount of justices who tend to lean both ways. I think that fosters a better discussion and more thought-out policies other than kind of knowing where the court's going to lean on every issue. So it's not as much about having it lean right as it is having people on both sides.
Michelle, Tim, I think that's a good observation. Michelle, and that's kind of where we've been for quite a while. Now, that's not something that many Democrats and liberals like the idea of, but does Tim have a legitimate point on this?
Well, I think it is important to recognize that the Supreme Court is supposed to serve as the final kind of arbiter for the most complex questions that face us as Americans in our society. And yet, what has happened is a radical change of the way that we view the court. I mean, even thinking or considering about the court leaning one way or the other, I believe, because of the way that we think about our politics, has damaged the integrity of the court wholesale. And we've actually seen, while the court is one of the institutions that remains with a pretty high approval and favorability rate, that those numbers have continued to decline. Because in many ways, we've made our arguments around the court centered on our own political beliefs and not really looking at what the role of a fair-minded, independent judicial arbiter should be. You know, while I am someone who certainly would not agree with all the precedent that has come down from the Berger, Rehnquist, and Roberts courts, the court writ large should always be extremely hesitant to change fundamental constitutional principles.
Okay.
And yet, when you look at cases like Citizens United versus FEC, you had five conservatives who literally undermined a century of law that fundamentally changed the rules governing election spending in order, I think many people would say, to favor the interests of wealthy and of big businesses. And now that was a part of a number of cases that continue to do that, whether it was the McCutcheon decision that eliminated dollar limits for contributions, and then Citizens United. You find yourself in a place where the use of having unlimited funds from general treasuries to influence federal elections, that was the first time in American history that corporations were written to have the same right as ordinary people to spend money in elections. And so I think that that's a troubling turn from the way that we've looked at precedent previously. And what that means for real people is, if most American people are working hard to send their kids to school, to save money for retirement, and we are supposed to believe that your individual power is the same as multi-billion international companies to influence the election, I just don't think that that's a fair or a reasonable expectation of how the law plays out. And I think that that's an area for concern. And I think that's why President Obama and his philosophy of looking at his judicial picks was someone who understands how the law actually works in practice. And it's unfortunate that I don't think that we're going to see nominees that understand how the law influences real people in real life.
Michelle, it's really been a pleasure to have your insight and your experience in the conversation. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
Michelle Jawando is a Supreme Court expert at the Center for American Progress. Kimberly Atkins continues with us. She covers the U.S. Supreme Court. She's a columnist for the Boston Herald. And I want to hear from you this morning on where these decisions around the U.S. Supreme Court figured into your choice for president. We're hearing a lot from a lot of people who are concerned about who the president-elect will nominate. If you were a Trump voter, were you thinking about the U.S. Supreme Court? Are there issues now that may head to the court that that you're glad you supported Donald Trump on, that you're concerned about, the kind of rise to the top of, as you think about issues that this administration will manage? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieMBR. And right back to your calls and your questions on the other side of news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. You're talking about the Supreme Court. Justices today sided with Samsung and its big money smartphone patent fight with Apple. The Supreme Court threw out an appeals court ruling that said the South Korean company had to pay a $399 million penalty to its American rival for copying key iPhone designs. The justices, in their 8-0 ruling, sent the case back to the lower court for further proceedings. Also, the Supreme Court ruling on an insider trading case for the first time in two decades upheld a Chicago man's conviction in a decision that could make it easier to prosecute people accused of profiting from confidential information. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says he believes President-elect Donald Trump is to blame for an increase in reported New York hate crime incidents. De Blasio spoke at a news conference where the topics included weekend threats made against an off-duty Muslim New York Police Department officer while she was with her teenage son in Brooklyn. De Blasio said Trump used hate speech during his campaign. There's been no change overnight in the number of bodies recovered from what remains of an Oakland warehouse. A sheriff's deputy says 36 bodies have been recovered and 26 of their families have been notified. Another 9 bodies have been tentatively identified. The fire broke out during a dance party on Friday night. And it's a first for Beyoncé. She now has she's the first artist to earn Grammy nominations in the pop, rock, R&B, and rap categories in the same year. She leads with 9 overall nominations for the 2017 Grammys, including bids for Album of the Year with Lemonade and Song and Record of the Year with Formation. Adele is also nominated for Album, Record, and Song of the Year. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
If you have to get back to work or run some errands and you can't listen to this whole conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court, you know where to find it on the podcast. Right now on the podcast, The Art and Science of Grace. We had some great calls for that show. And The Psychology of Policing. All right there for you when you want to listen. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our listeners and by the University of Minnesota, driven to protect human rights and solve the world's biggest challenges. Learn more at discover.umn.edu.
Programming supported by Minnesota Historical Society Press, publisher of U.S. Bank Stadium, a behind-the-scenes look at the new home of the Minnesota Vikings, from design plans and construction photos to stadium amenities and game day activities. More at shopmnhs.org.
Here's something I want you to start thinking about for 10 o'clock. What's the song that was your music milestone? A song that still evokes the kind of emotion that the best music can. Tweet that song title to me at Carrie NPR and then tune in at 10 o'clock when Mark Myers joins us to talk about his new book, Anatomy of a Song. If you love music, I do. I know a lot of you do. It is so much fun. And we're going to play tons of music at 10. So come back for that. Back to the discussion now. Kimberly Atkins with us from the Boston Herald as we talk about the future of the U.S. Supreme Court. And Steph, a comment off the page.
Yeah, Rob says, I didn't vote for Trump, but pro-life concerns and respect for religious liberty kept me from voting for Clinton as well. He went third party. He says, we need to reform the Supreme Court. They make some of the most impactful decisions in the country, and I'm sick of feeling compelled to vote a certain way to make sure it doesn't go off the rails for the next 15 years. I would like to see term limits for the Supreme Court.
Kimberly, what about the idea of that? Does it ever get anywhere?
It has not yet, but it's been discussed a lot. A lot of folks have come up with a plan, for example, that it would be an 18-year limit on Supreme Court justices to sort of encourage some of the turnover you see and not allow one president to have such a long-lasting mark on the court. I think in the end, it will result in perhaps unintended consequences on the other side, as if you can foresee when Supreme Court vacancies are coming up, it really leads to over politicizing of the court that, as Michelle mentioned earlier, is not supposed to be a part of the court. The court's supposed to rule objectively, not really rule with one mind on how much of a majority that's on the court and what cases are coming up and what they should or should not pick, given those political realities. So it's a discussion on both sides, but I don't think anything is changing anytime soon.
Can I just ask you what you think the future of the power of Justice Kennedy and his swing vote will be? Does some of that diminish once they replace Scalia?
It won't diminish so much once they replace Scalia, because that will be a conservative filling in for a conservative. Mm-hmm. It will definitely change with the next appointment if it is to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because then the conservatives will have five votes on the court without Kennedy. And he won't serve as that key decider that he has for over a decade now.
Call here from Christy in Minneapolis. Hey, Christy, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Morning. Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to point out I'm with the Courts Matter Minnesota Coalition here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just wanted to point out and maybe get your take on this. So right now there are currently 38 judicial emergencies, and we just wanted to highlight that not only will a Trump presidency impact the Supreme Court vacancy, but it also impacts federal district courts, and that has far-reaching implications beyond just a Supreme Court vacancy, and was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that.
A really good point. Kimberly, what can you say to that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, for the past several years, there really has been a logjam in appointments to federal courts from the district court level through the appellate, as well as now with the current vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, where Republicans in the Senate have stalled a lot of these nominations, and you've seen a lot of vacancies. So if that floodgate opens now and President-elect Trump is able to fill those positions, it will have a major impact. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court tends to take up cases that split the courts, where different courts come out to different conclusions, and you see different applications of law in different parts of the country. And that the Supreme Court doesn't want that to happen. They come up with a solution so that there is a uniformity. If there is less differences, if there are more courts ruling unanimously in conservative ways on a lot of these issues won't even make it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think that is a very true and very important point.
Kimberly, it has been the case, though, that when presidents have thought they were appointing tried and true conservatives, those justices turned out to be more moderate than perhaps that president expected.
That's absolutely true. And I think that's something we may see, especially as President-elect Trump is looking at a lot of people from state courts and other places where there may not be as clear of a record on specific issues like abortion, specific issues like gun control that don't tend to come up the state system. Those tend to be federal court issues. There might be some surprises there. And you're absolutely right. I mean, people like John Paul Stevens, who was a Republican appointee, turned out to be one of the more liberal justices on the court. David Souter as well, an appointee who turned more liberal in the end. We might see that happen in these cases where we don't know exactly what the jurisprudence of a particular nominee will be until he or she is on the court.
Chrissy in Cotton, Minnesota says, I'm an RN who works in OB, so it was important for me to uphold Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. We have a drug crisis with women who are low income. If they didn't have abortion options, they might hurt themselves. On Twitter, Sarah says, women fought hard for Roe v. Wade. We will fight again if it's overturned, but here's hoping my reproductive rights remain my rights. Steph, off the page.
Jeff has a comment that's kind of like what we were just talking about, that you never know how people act until they're on court. He says, if you watch the court, you'll see the so-called conservatives switch sides on major, major issues like gay marriage and the ACA, but the liberal justices never seem to break rank on major issues.
Is that true, Kim?
I think in recent history, we have seen that. I think the votes of justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan have been far more predictable than the votes of some of the other justices, including, as you mentioned, Chief Justice John Roberts, who famously sort of crafted mm-hmm. together a majority in order to essentially save the Health Care Act from being overturned in that really a big decision on the individual mandate. And that surprised and frankly angered a lot of conservatives who thought he was a strong and reliable vote against that law. So you have seen this happen. I think it depends not only on you know, one's political view, which, again, the judge is supposed to rule, a justice is supposed to rule accordance to the Constitution, not in accordance to political views. But people are human. They don't live in a legal vacuum. But it also depends on the approach to how you reason on these both these statutory and constitutional issues. People approach it differently, where you can have two conservatives who can come to different conclusions. For example, Justice Antonin Scalia often ruled against or not in accordance to a lot of the other conservatives on issues involving the Fourth Amendment and search and seizure. He promoted very strong Fourth Amendment protections for defendants in these cases, where some of the other conservative judges didn't, based on his the way he approached constitutional interpretation. So there is a lot of room, a wiggle room, depending on what the issue is.
Amal says, called to say in Minneapolis, "I think the Supreme Court nomination is a long game of voter suppression and barring immigration. The Republicans are trying to stem the tide of the demographic change in the U.S. That's the effect that these conservative nominees will have." Kim, is there an immigration case that you already know is kind of headed to the court yet or not?
I think there will be more.
Okay.
I mean, right now on the docket, there is a case that involves whether detainees can be indefinitely held without a hearing. And that clearly will affect, if anything, President-elect Trump's plan to boost deportations once he comes in. So that's a case that was already in the pipeline that can affect his administration. I'm sure we will see a lot more challenges. And on the voting rights issue, I think that's one of the top issues that we will definitely see some change in, probably long before we see Roe v. Wade or gun control touched by this court right now. And there are now, and there will continue to be, challenges to redistricting efforts that are being challenged as racial gerrymanders. There's the court heard an argument in two of those cases out of North Carolina and Virginia this week. Those will continue. The court recently repealed a part of the Voting Rights Act that gave the federal government the ability to pre-clear voting rights law changes in states, and left it up to Congress to come up with a new formula. I doubt that will be forthcoming in the new administration, and we will see the effects of that moving forward. So voting rights will be a very active issue where we could see major changes in the next several years.
I was just going to get to Kate in St. Paul, and I think she had to drop, but she was going to say, "I'm a reluctant Trump supporter, and one of the issues is a judge who can uphold First Amendment rights. I don't want the government to overreach into what the church is allowed to do." To Larry in Minneapolis. Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, I'm an attorney, and I've been following the court for a long time, even when I was a kid. And what I'm interested in is that the Republicans, by my count, had 12 straight appointments from 1968 to 1992, because the Republicans had the presidency for all but 4 years, and Carter didn't have any appointments. And so in my view, what's viewed as the center right now is quite a bit to the right of what I'd say the center was in 1965. And, and people that are viewed as liberal right now really would have been centrists. I mean, we don't have like a Thurgood Marshall or a Brennan or a Hugo Black on the court right now. The people on the left, I would say, are really centrist. And I'm interested in what you guys think about that.
Kimberly, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting perception. I think in your Supreme Court history is probably a little better than mine, but I think in the past we have seen courts that have not seemed to fall on a clear ideological split in a way that the current court has. I think that that's the result of a lot of things, including a change in how justices are confirmed. Both Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg were confirmed unanimously by the Senate, and their confirmation was far less political than those of, say, cabinet positions. Now you see, I'm not sure there will ever again be a unanimous confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. I think that you've seen people appoint people who presidents appoint people who are far more ideological, under more ideological tests than legal tests, as you've seen in the past. And that might be the result of the court you see now might be the result of those changes.
Just briefly, Kimberly, how soon do you think President-elect Trump will make this nomination? And then, you know, how quickly do the gears start to grind towards a confirmation hearing?
Yes, I check my Twitter regularly to see if the president-elect has made that choice. He said that it is coming soon. He says he's at this point narrowed this list of 21 down to about 3 or 4, and that he would be announcing who that is fairly soon. That would be taken up by the next Congress after the president is installed. But I think particularly for the Supreme Court choice, that's going to move fairly quickly. As I think Republicans will be keen on filling that spot as quickly as possible.
It sounds like you think that he's going to make the nomination before he's inaugurated.
That's what he's promised
okay.
to do. So I'm expecting that within the next several weeks, probably at the most.
Hey, it's always really great for us to have the benefit of your experience and your reporting. So thank you very much. Really good to have you here.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Kimberly Atkins is chief Washington reporter, and she's a columnist for the Boston Herald, and she covers the U.S. Supreme Court.